And it's remarkable how that mind, the proud human mind that is asking for reasons for everything, will, when it sees the will, that's a strange sentence, when it sees the will adamant, will say to itself, this is the mind soliloquizing, well, come to think of it, most things that I accept I don't understand anyhow. So, I guess I better go along, because without this partnership, the corporation can't go on, namely the mind and the will. So much for the relationship of freedom to faith, to prayer. Faith tells us we are incomplete beings. Now, depending on the writer, you can camouflage the words in nicer language. I like this. We're incomplete. Period. We have nature, but we need grace. In fact, you can almost drop the word nature, because what we have is nature. That's what we're born with. That's another name for nature. And we sure need much more. All that we need, beyond what we have, that we're born into the world with, is grace. And we need it. And faith tells us, as much as we need this grace to reach the destiny for which we were made, we won't get it unless we ask for it. So a good, or a very good, theological definition of prayer is asking for grace. Now, we can ask in a thousand ways. We don't have to move a muscle or speak a word. This grace, then, requires the prayer of sacrifice, the prayer of action, the prayer of suffering, the prayer of ritual in the sacraments, and always the prayer of words. But long before we articulate in words what we need, there are so many ways of nonverbal communication with God, which are our ways of telling Him, Lord, I need You. And this is the important conjunction, we shall pray if we want to. So that I don't hesitate saying that the most sublime function of our free will is the choice to pray. Some choose to do so, others don't. Those who choose to pray obtain what they ask for. Those who do not choose to pray will not obtain what they need. And, as the Church has told us, even solemnly, will not be saved. Who will be saved? Those who pray. Who will be lost? Those who do not pray. And teaching as I do, the various religious systems, apart from Christianity, I can assure you, most of the human race prays. The tragedy is that some who call themselves Christians, and may God forgive them, even religious, have lost the vision that even the Muslims and the Hindus have. They know they must pray. But this necessity of praying is a conditional necessity. And the condition is whether we choose to do so. Because we are not obliged to pray. And God then, in His mysterious providence, He is not obliged to give us. That's the essence of grace. What God is not obliged to give us unless we pray, then we bind Him by His own fidelity. But only if we pray. Regarding sin. Sin is essentially a deliberate choice that a creature makes, somehow in preference to choosing the Creator. If the choice is a complete rejection of the Creator, that is, of certain things which God says, if you choose this, you reject me, then we call it grave sin. When it's less than that, we call it venial. To be stressed, and I cannot stress it too much, is that sin is in the will. We don't sin with the mind. We don't sin with our feelings or emotions. They can be very powerful, and they are always seductive. Sin always comes to us under the guise of good, some pleasure, which then tempts the will, and the will, if it sins, gives in to it. Whenever we sin, then, we choose something or someone that we want, even though we know that God does not want this thing or this person for us. And we cannot comfort ourselves by saying, well, but she has it. That's not the point. God has a different providence for each one of us. Sin, then, is a conscious conflict of two freedoms, God's and ours. Every time we sin, we cross our will with the will of God. The last dimension of our reflection of this relationship of freedom to various aspects of our spiritual life is the relationship of freedom to grace. Holiness, we know, is more than just avoiding sin. It assumes that we try to become more and more sinless. Essentially, holiness is the practice of virtue beyond what we are obliged to avoid God's punishments. There are many ways in which the avoidance of sin, which is basically morality, can be contrasted with holiness, which is spirituality. But one comparison that is, I think, very easy to grasp is that morality is that practice of virtue to which we are bound under penalty of God's punishments. It is then obedience to God's justice, respecting His divine rights over us, His rights over us as our Creator and Master. Certain things He tells us, do this or don't do that. And if you do, He will displease Me and I will punish you. A vast field, that's the whole moral order. But holiness begins where morality leaves off. It assumes the moral order. It assumes that a person, for us, be religious, is seriously intent on avoiding sin, but wants to. Oh, that's the freedom. Wants to go beyond. This holiness, then, consists, as by now we've heard and read a thousand and more than a thousand times, consists in the following of Christ, which can mean many things, this following of Christ. You follow somebody when you walk behind the person. Well, I suppose that figure of speech could be used too, but it doesn't quite mean that. Well, Christ is trekking in front and we're trekking behind. It must mean something much deeper. This following, then, means that we follow Him in the practice of what He practiced. It's as simple and as demanding as that. What He did, because He became man, to show us how to really please God, we try to do the same. The attributes of God are infinite. Therefore, the immutability of Christ is literally infinite. On the other hand, there are certain things which Christ did, which we in the pursuit of holiness are to commit ourselves to trying to reduplicate in our own lives, that stand out in Christian spirituality, and they are especially four. The first is imitating Christ in His practice of charity. Hence, for us as religious, we enter a community, unless we have any misconceptions about what the purpose of community life is. This is it. The purpose of community life is to imitate Jesus Christ in the practice of charity. And you find out very soon that if you thought you were practicing charity before you became a religious, Lord, not this. Yes, this. People you never thought you'd meet, and you discover you've got to live with. So the practice of charity. The sacrifice of possessions. There are some explicit, many implicit passages in the Gospels in which the poverty of Christ is dramatically revealed. And it couldn't be more dramatically revealed than in those two scenes, Bethlehem, a child lying in a manger, and a man condemned as a criminal on the cross and buried in a stranger's tomb. It means the sacrifice of marital joys and pleasures. And that's the way I like to put it. Any other way it can be either twisted to mean what it doesn't mean is the sacrifice of something great, of something good, of something which is satisfying. Otherwise, as by now I know I've told you a dozen times. Sacrifice means that I surrender what I like. If I don't like it, you can't even make a sacrifice. So as the joys and pleasures of marriage and this business of chastity is not only the sacrifice of venereal pleasure in the reproductive organs of our body, it means so many sacrifices of the kind of things that we as people who have vowed ourselves to this life are meant to give up. And give up, especially where the giving up is hardest, inside. We might have enjoyed it. Christ might have. It's Jesus that we are imitating. And finally, the sacrifice of our autonomous use of our talents, of our time, of our skills, of our education. Capitalized under that very prosaic word, obedience. Notice it is not the sacrifice of our talents. I didn't say that. Or our time, of our skills or abilities. It is the sacrifice of the autonomous use of these talents, time, skills. And that we should be just as, indeed, more eager to use our talent and time according to the directives of obedience as we would have been had we had the autonomous choice of how to use what we have. But we're talking about freedom. We must choose to do these things. And I've got three words underlined. We must choose. Nobody else. And being in the religious life 20 or 25 years doesn't change the picture. The choice is still ours. We must choose. And we must choose. Otherwise, the moment we stop choosing to live beyond the requirements of the moral law, we have thereby chosen to lapse from the pursuit of holiness. And we must choose, which means we must choose not to have the opposite of what the choice of the imitation of Christ requires. We must then choose to rise above sin. We must choose to see the value of Christian perfection and expose the mind and tell the mind, now look here, you haven't been doing much thinking these days. I'm telling you what to think about. And the mind may rebel or at least complain. Who are you to be bossing me around? Well, now look, you've only got one boss. That's me. To see the value of Christian perfection, to see the importance of becoming Christ-like, to appreciate and to be willing to admit the means necessary to fulfill our hopes. It is not enough to choose something which we hope for, the goal. We must also choose the means. Otherwise, we can really be frustrated. And the more we hear about the beauties of sanctity, the worse it's going to get. Because then, having chosen an end, we will not reach that goal. We shall not become holy unless we also choose and keep choosing the necessary means. This means we must choose to sacrifice self in order to put on Christ. And of course, the hardest choice we can ever make is the choice to choose Him in preference to self. And we've got to choose to persevere in these choices until death. When? Won't that be wonderful? We won't have to be making these difficult choices anymore. We will keep our freedom, of course. But then, there will be no possibility of ever making a wrong choice. Thank you, sisters.